And welcome to this Friday edition of A Public Affair. I'm your guest host, John Quinlan. And we're looking forward to a wonderful hour spent talking about the life of Bob La Follette on this, the eve of a whole series of events connected to Fighting Bob Fest. And very pleased to have my guest in studio, Nancy Unger, who is Bob La Follette's biographer. Nancy, welcome to A Public Affair.
Oh, it's a big thrill to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's good to have you here. And I think we, before we get kicked off here, we'd like to just take a little bit of a step back and take a broader overview of Bob Fest. And Mark, do we have Ed on the line? Ed Garvey, who is one of the principal people behind it, and certainly one of the people that has carried this festival forward, is here to join us. Ed, welcome to A Public Affair.
Thank you. It's always fun to be with you.
All right. Good to have you here.
Hi, Nancy.
Hey, Ed.
The great thing about Bob Fest is that some wonderful speakers keep coming back year after year. It's something you look forward to in terms of a tradition and that sense of familiarity about these wonderful progressive speakers. But of course, you're always introducing new folks into the mix. Why don't we start there? Who are some of the folks that are coming this year that haven't been there in past years?
Well, probably the most well known, of course, is Jesse Jackson Sr. He's never been to Bob Fest before, and will be coming this year for the first time. We've had Laura Flanders in Madison, but she's never really been at Bob Fest before, so we're looking forward to having her there. And Tom Hartman, who I think is truly one of the intelligent voices on radio these days, and a real pleasure. We also think there's a young senator by the name of Feingold who will be dropping in this evening as well. I don't know if you've heard of him. But he's running for re-election. So it's going to be an interesting event, and part of it is, you know, it takes place as we see this incredible stuff unfolding with respect to Muslims and the lack of understanding by the American people. So it'll be an important meeting, I think, for people to get together and say, how do we deal with this sort of bias and nonsense?
You know, a lot of folks have just reflected in this year when Fox News tends to cover the vacant lot where the Tea Party just occurred, and you know, and all that emphasis is on right wing gatherings. You know, this is going to be a wonderful antidote for that.
Well, that's what we started out 9 years ago, and we said, you know, why don't we have a celebration once a year of our victories? Because you know, it's easy enough to understand some of the defeats. We had defeated Perrier Nestle because they were going to take spring water out of Wisconsin and sell it all over the country. And so to celebrate, we got together for breakfast at the Wisconsin Dells. And we said, well, why don't we meet once a year and not just talk about the victories, but also talk about how to have more victories by being more active and working more, closer together. That became Fighting Bob Fest. And from then on, we found great people like Nancy Unger. And pretty soon we had ourselves quite a show.
And just to mention to folks something that's ongoing throughout the year is a great website. And I know Nancy's been a contributor to that and a lot of the other past speakers. How do folks find that?
www.fightingbob.com. And we get about 15,000 visits a week. So it's not in the high numbers, but it's more focused, more concentrated. And we get people like, as you say, as Nancy to write for us I think we've posted about 1,200 articles in the last 5 years.
Wow. Well, let's get to some of the basics here, talking about at least two of the events that are happening. In addition to Bob Fest up at Sauk County Fairgrounds in Baraboo tomorrow, there's a great event tonight as well. Is that right?
That's right. Tonight at 7:30 at the Barrymore. That's where I first met Tom Hartman, actually. And he does this wonderful talk with Bernie Sanders on Fridays. So I think it's going to be fun this evening. And Laura Flanders will be here as well from Grit TV, and she's always a treat to listen to. So,
oh, she sure is.
And then with Jim Hightower there to introduce Russ Feingold, I think everybody's going to get their money's worth.
Are there tickets involved with the?
It's a $10 per head ticket, but we've never been too much of a stickler on it. If you can't afford it, we'll get WORT to contribute it.
And when do things kick off tomorrow? And well, thank you. and you give just a brief idea of where the fairgrounds are and some of just a little logistics.
Yeah, if you go to the website, fightingbobfest.org, it'll give you directions right to the fairgrounds in Baraboo. I'm so bad with directions that I hesitate to do it myself. So The website will tell you exactly how to get there. It takes you about 35 minutes from Madison to get to Baraboo.
Yeah.
And you know, you shouldn't have too much trouble.
You take the interstate to Highway 33, if nothing else. So
that's
yeah.
Right.
Actually, just wanted to touch on just a couple of the other folks that I saw that who are going to be there. David Cooper, I don't think he's been there before, has he?
No, he hasn't. And this is kind of an interesting one because David was the police chief in Madison, you know, during some rather turbulent times. He's now a minister, and we thought he was an outspoken chief of police, very much a pioneer with community policing, and somebody who understood that the role of the police in society is not to intimidate, but rather to cooperate and work with people. So we think David brings to BobFest a certain set of values that sort of go outside the normal box of politics, and so we're looking forward to hearing David speak.
Another person outside the normal box who, of course, also was very much in the halls of power is Congressman Obie, and I think anyone who was at Gaylord Nelson's memorial remembers both his stirring speech and then later playing Amazing Grace on the harmonica as it echoed through the Capitol, remembers what a powerful orator he is.
Yes, he is, and you know, David's been in public office, I think, for 42 years, so it'll be fascinating to hear how he views things now, particularly when we think about Afghanistan. And you know, he's been trying to warn the administration to get out of there because it's just we're going broke and there's no way that we can win. So I'm really looking forward to hearing what David has to say. I go back a long way with David. We were both at the University of Wisconsin together, and so it's going to be kind of fun and maybe a bit nostalgic.
Yeah, I popped up when I was 4 years old in 1964. We lived across the street from him in Wausau, and Win Spencer, who later headed up his office, was my first babysitter. So anyway,
I had
some
right?
connections there too. Yeah, then went back in '92 and worked on the campaign with them all up there. But anyway, good stuff. Anything else that you want to bring to our attention in terms of some of the great things happening?
Well, I just think that this decision by the United States Supreme Court in Citizen United, where the decision was that corporations can participate fully in the political process and there will be no true restrictions on the amount of money they can put into campaigns, is the most frightening thing that's happened in a long time. Because, for example, if a major corporation is in trouble in the Senate, why not dump $5 million or $10 million or $20 million into Russ Feingold's race, because they would hardly miss it and it's a tax write-off anyway. So we have to get that reversed. John Boniface will be here for the first time to talk about a constitutional amendment. We'll have Mike McCabe and others speaking about publicly financed campaigns. But I'm not sure that people have fully understood the significance of saying that corporations are like people, only with even more rights, because they don't have to tell us where they get their money or where they contribute it. And so it's going to be an important part of fighting BobFest. And I suspect that Nancy Younger is going to have plenty to say about campaign finance reform.
No, absolutely. I think you know, powerful part of this hour is some of the resonances, things happening in the here and now, with, of course, Bob La Follette. And as we close out here, Ed, your reflections on the guy that the whole thing is named for. Nancy was just remarking earlier, I think folks sometimes in Wisconsin take for granted that, you know, although we, of course, have a special attachment and pride in him, this is someone who made an impact on the national stage.
Oh, he certainly did. And, you know, he wrote, he said the railroads figured out early on that either the state was going to control them or they would control the state, and they decided that they were going to control the state. And what was fascinating to me is how La Follette set about giving freedom to the voters of Wisconsin to name their candidates through the open primary and then to vote with them through the secret ballot. And almost everywhere you go in this country, if you talk about Bob La Follette, people know who you're talking about and have a certain sense of pride about his accomplishments. I mean, I think of all the changes in Wisconsin, for example, the Public Service Commission trying to guard the rights and to protect the public, open meetings, open records, open primaries. He really had a tremendous impact. And I think probably influenced greatly Gaylord Nelson and Bob Kastenmeyer and other progressives who've run for office in Wisconsin.
Just one last thought. It occurs to me, of course, there's contrast, the different years, different political currents that were going through the country, but a bit of a contrast between this year and, say, the last couple of years. I think in terms of folks feeling maybe a bit dispirited, a bit like The wind's gone out of their sails. How do you answer someone who is feeling like they can't make a difference as we all gather together tomorrow?
Well, you know, I look at it, I have grandchildren. I'm trying to imagine having them over to the house to sit down and say, now, okay, kids, here's the problem. We can't do anything about climate change. We can't do anything about coal-burning power plants. We can't do anything about the corruption of our political process. So sorry about that, kids, but good luck to you. I mean, you can't imagine yourself saying that. So I my message to progressives is, look, this is all about a fight, and who's going to win the fight is the one who cares the most about what we have. And we have at least a semblance of democracy now. And if there are people who say, oh, well, the powers that be are too powerful to take over, you know, tell that to Jesse Jackson or to Diane Nash or to the women who won the right to vote. I mean, they've changed constitutions, they've changed the law, and we can do it again.
Absolutely. Ed Garvey, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, and I look forward to hearing Nancy.
All right. Take care, and best of luck. And Nancy, any final words there to Ed?
Oh, bye-bye, Ed. I'll see you. What time tomorrow are we starting?
Sorry, I guess it's off the line, but yeah, according to, we'll find the schedule in a second, but I think it's roughly about 9 o'clock.
I think that's about right.
Yeah, 8:30 is the welcome, 9 o'clock we start off with Tammy Baldwin.
Very good.
So, well, I was starting in a basic place. One of the things I was discovering, and I guess I should have known this before, but you aren't a native Wisconsinite, and yet Bob La Follette, someone very early on, caught your attention. Can you put that in perspective for us?
Well, I was born and raised in Seattle, and when I was in graduate school, I was casting about for a topic and read this little paragraph about Bob La Follette and thought, how come I've never heard of this guy before? This is really an amazing American. I looked at all the things that he achieved, and so that was how I got to write this this biography. And people are always asking me, you know, you're not from Wisconsin? It's like, you know, no, La Follette is a national figure, and he belongs to all of us. And it frustrates me no end that outside of Wisconsin, so many people don't know La Follette's name, but they know Joe McCarthy's. Mm-hmm. And so I'm on a one-woman campaign to make sure that as many people know about Bob La Follette as they do Joe McCarthy.
Now, historians maybe are outside that category. Bob La Follette constantly is popping up in the names of the top senators of all time, is that right?
Oh yeah, he's continually making the list, and he's also on greatest governors of all time. I mean, this was really an amazing politician who, in my opinion, just does not get his due, and particularly because, I mean, as a historian, I find him very interesting, and that's fine for me, but that's not important for other people. What other people, I think, need to know is that this is a man who so much of what he said still resonates today. We can still learn from him. Unfortunately, so many of the problems he faced, we're still facing. Yeah. But I think we can see, well, what did he and the other progressives, what did they do that worked? And how can we, you know, learn from that? And what didn't work so that we'll know what to avoid? So I see this as a really, it's a practical way of trying to deal with today's problems.
And of course, much of what he faced, in proportion to what we're facing today, he had some pretty daunting situations to face, including the specter of corporate power that was just kind of overwhelming the government at the time.
Oh, absolutely. And when people say, and I understand why people get discouraged and so forth, but if you look at the level of corruption that was going on in La Follette's day, it's like, no, this is not an unprecedented problem that we're facing. Things were really extreme in that day. And as Ed suggests, La Follette didn't just say, well, it's out of our hands, it's too big to fight. He said, okay, how are we going to fight it?
In case you're just joining us, just want to reset the show for you. Again, our guest for the remainder of the hour is Nancy Unger. She's the author of Finding Bob La Follette, The Righteous Reformer. And our focus in general is on the upcoming exciting weekend of events happening at Fighting Bob Fest, including the events at the Barrymore tonight, and then beginning at 8:30 tomorrow morning up at the Sauk County Fairgrounds in Baraboo. Long day's schedule of some powerful speakers, some breakout panels around the middle of the day. Lots of stuff to look forward to. Mark, did we still have a caller? And we invite your participation in this conversation. Give us a call at 608-256-2001. Caller, what is your comment or question?
Well, I have a question for Nancy, but first I had wanted to ask Ed about why in the past 8 years Bob Fest has never had any contrary voice concerning 9/11 truth, any critic of the government cover-up, And to this day, even to tomorrow, there's nobody officially going to address that deep problem of the big lie of 9/11. My question for Nancy is, when Robert La Follette confronted the outbreak of World War I, the assassination of the Archduke in the Balkans, did he understand that this was a kind of a frame-up and pretext for the war machines of Europe to erupt in their bloodbath, just as 9/11 was a pretext for these monsters in the Pentagon and Washington to do the same? Thank you very much for your work, Nancy.
Thank you. Well, I know La Follette didn't speak very much about the assassination, what was going on in Europe. He was much more concerned about what was going on at home. And what he saw at home was that this was going to be actually, if you could just give me one second, I'll tell you exactly what he said. War and rumors of war are a dreadful diversion for peoples demanding juster distribution of wealth. War is the money changer's opportunity and the social reformer's doom. So he believed very strongly that the United States was being very hypocritical when it proclaimed itself the, quote, he called, quote, custodians of peace and instructors in democratic ideals to less enlightened peoples, when their own nation continued to have problems with racism, sexism, and political corruption. And he really denounced economic and political imperialism. Quote, he says, the rights of foreigners to govern themselves according to their own standards are as sacred as American sovereignty within U.S. borders. Whether a government is good or bad according to our standards, it is not up to us to overthrow it. We have enough to do here at home. Now, he wasn't a total pacifist, and once we were in the war, he supported the war measures and wanted to see the United States win and so forth, but he was very much concerned about that many people were going to profit from this war and other people were going to lose their lives because of it, and wanted people to go into this with their eyes wide open about what war really means.
It's hard sometimes as we draw parallels between an earlier era and the present day to not sometimes conflate things that don't belong together and everything. But I guess it does strike me that a commonality in terms of Bob La Follette's opposition to the war is that at least initially was he was attacked pretty virulently, and it had an element of racial or cultural bias to it. He was accused of being a German conspirator, and of course in a state that has many German citizens and everything. I think that probably had an extra sting. But anyway, it just reminds me today of maybe connections to that Ed was alluding to in terms of conflating a whole people, in this case people who are Muslim, with a conflict and getting all this kind of mixed up. I mean, does this sort of make sense?
Yeah, no, it does make sense, and it's kind of discouraging in a way to have so much of it still resonate so powerfully. La Follette it's difficult to speak for someone who is long gone, but I know he was very concerned about or very dedicated to the separation of church and state, and it was unusual for a man in his day and age as a U.S. senator, to not be affiliated with a church. And he felt strongly about this. So on one occasion when his religious beliefs, or rather lack thereof, were attacked, he said, "I am not a member of any church. Some of my family are Baptists, some Unitarians. I state the above, not because I think you or any other American citizen has any right to the information, but because I want you to appreciate, if you can, the resentment I feel that any man in this country dedicated to civil liberty and religious freedom should characterize the religious beliefs of another as dry rot. Do you not think that each one of us should be permitted to settle this one question directly with his God?" I mean, he was really angry about this. He believed in this country's dedication to religious freedom.
Well, it brings us down to a more basic level in terms of the folks that are making assumptions about President Obama's faith and questioning him and everything. Bob La Follette is just saying, that's not relevant. That's
yes.
not the nature of our
yes,
country.
Yes, that's not the point. In fact, he wasn't usually this open about it. And often when he was asked, "So, Senator, where do you go to church?" he would list wherever he had just been to a funeral most recently. "Well, most recently I was at such and such." He'd kind of try try to skirt the issue. But finally, he'd had enough. You know, what difference does it make? And that's not what this country is about. We have to live up to those ideals.
Once again, we want to issue that invitation to join in this conversation with Robert LaFollette, biographer, Nancy Unger, 256-2001. I believe we have another call on the line. What is your comment or question, please?
Yeah, hi. I want to go back to what Ed Garvey was saying just for a moment. Sorry to interrupt the current speaker.
That's all right.
But if you're going to BobFest tomorrow, there's a group called South Central Wisconsin Move to Amend that's trying to get a ballot measure on the April ballot here in Madison opposing the Citizens United decision. This is a resolution that will say basically that corporations aren't people and money isn't speech, and if we get enough signatures, there'll be a ballot measure in April in Madison on this, and there'll be plenty of people in lime green shirts out at BobFest. You can sign there. There'll be people tonight at the Barrymore, and there'll be people for the next many weeks trying to get enough signatures to do this, so I hope your listeners will do that.
Caller, just if I could put a question to you, I mean, for those of you who are working on that issue, and obviously excesses of corporate power and corporations being treated as if they were people, is something resonant with a lot of what Bob LaFollette had to deal with at the turn of the 1920th centuries. Do you find inspiration? Do you feel that history is still relevant today?
I definitely do. I think there's a lot of echoes of that era of his work and other people's work here in the state, the Wisconsin Idea. We're a progressive state, except for when we're not. So I would hope we can return to that. I can tell you I have a wooden marionette puppet of Bob LaFollette sitting in my house.
Ah, okay. Well, good stuff. Well, look forward to seeing you tomorrow. Thanks for your call.
Okay.
And we've touched on this, but let's if we could, just revisit maybe some of the circumstances that Bob LaFollette faced in his career and you know, this ongoing effort to bring government to the people and take it away from some of the elites.
Well, I think many people are surprised to learn that it was LaFollette who really pushed to have the 17th Amendment, which brought us the direct election of senators. So the Tea Partiers right now are trying to repeal.
Which just seems – I don't understand how that's connected to anything consistent.
Matt Bai of the New York Times called me and said, have you ever heard of any group ever asking for – less democracy,
yeah.
to actually have, you know, less democratic, you know, in this, you know, a very formal sort of profound way. So, you know, LaFollette, you know, he pushed that through because, you know, the candidates for the Senate were being picked in backroom deals by legislators and so forth. And he said, no, you know, this is the people's government. The people should decide. The people should nominate. He called for direct elections, direct nominations and so forth. So, that was one of the things that, I mean, in LaFollette's day, something else he pushed for was civil service reform. Now, this is not a sexy topic, but you have to think back in those days. You can read newspaper ads that you're looking for a civil service job. You're going to be a secretary, a postal carrier. These are good jobs. They have benefits. They have pensions and so forth. So you'd say, well, willing to kick back 15%, willing to kick back 20%. You didn't have to be good at your job. It was just how much you were willing to kick back. So LaFollette and others come up with civil service. You actually have to take a test. You have to be able to type if you're going to be a typist. You know, these are sort of some basic things to make the government better, to make it more responsible to the people. LaFollette's very big on the conservation of resources. He saw what happened to the forests, the woodlands of Wisconsin very, very quickly. He doesn't want that to happen in other places. So, you know, a lot of real sort of meat and potato, real issues, not kind of intellectual or highly political stuff. You know, how can we make life better for American citizens?
I know it's hard to weigh these things, but I mean, in some ways, is there an argument to be made that in some ways the task he faced back then was even more daunting, which maybe should give us some inspiration now, the fact that he did succeed?
Yeah, I think the only thing that, I mean, I think that's true. I mean, the corruption was so out there, it was so open, you know, the lobbying was so out of control. I mean, there was just so much corruption. I think the thing that he had going that the progressives, all of them, had going for them is that the nation at that time was newly industrialized and urbanized. It was kind of a brand new thing. And they really thought, okay, we, you know, we can really make this a much more equitable nation, and we can tame the beast and so forth. And I think it's a little harder for us. You know, you have Lyndon Johnson's Great Society. Okay, we're going to do it. We're going to make the Great Society. We're going to have the war on poverty. Well, and that kind of got sidetracked by the war in Vietnam. So I think that it's the thing that I think is a little harder for Americans today is, yeah, we've tried these reform movements, and, you know, they don't always necessarily work. But LaFollette was very savvy about this and said, you know, number one, who said democracy was easy?
Yeah.
You know, and he says America is not made; it's in the making, and it's something that you have to keep after, and it's very difficult, but it's worth those challenges and worth that, and we just can't afford the luxury of complacency or cynicism. That you just have to, you know, you, as Ed said, you want to sit down and say, "Oh, the hell with it. We'll just, you know, let it slide." No, it's a democracy is hard, and you have to work at it all the time.
I mean, it strikes me that there have always been skeptics going back to the founding fathers about pure democracy or populism or the people's will. And so, I mean, the Constitution itself is full of all these buffers that prevent, you know, in some ways, that from being expressed very directly. And so in some ways, I would imagine it's kind of a revolutionary idea. Maybe it seemed very logical that senators should be made, you know, the decisions should be made in another way and not necessarily due to the people because this is sort of a special role. I don't know. I mean, anyway, over the years, it seems like our understandings of the role of the people in democracy have really evolved. And this was just such an important turning point in that discussion.
Yeah. And I mean, the thing that I love to read LaFollette's speeches, although they are really, really long. My God, this guy would go on absolutely forever. They called him a four-pitcher man because that's how many pitchers of water he'd go through in a speech.
One tradition we're glad doesn't necessarily continue.
Yeah.
Process,
yeah.
Right?
So, but in reading them, you know, it's obviously utterly sincere. And even his greatest critics said, you can tell this man believes what he is saying. And he believed particularly in the people of Wisconsin. And he said, you know, if we can just get people to pay attention, to understand what's going on, and they let their voices be heard, you know, that was absolutely the key. But he believed that. And the other thing that I think is important to note, when he voted against U.S. entry into World War I, and he was just being crucified for this. His daughter said that was just kind of a little buzzing in his ears. What kept him going were the thousands of letters from people that he received all across the country, but mostly in Wisconsin, thanking him, you know, appreciating what he was doing. And I think that that's something that we forget sometimes, that our elected officials do need to hear from us. It's one of the easiest things we can do in the days of the internet, but it's really important that they hear, that they can say, I've heard from, you know, this many thousands of my constituents, and they can go onto the floor of Congress and talk about that, and they do. And I think that that's something that really struck me, that he wasn't just like, I have these ideas and this is what I'm doing. I've got the people behind me.
All right. Well, if you're just joining us, I just want to remind you that for the remainder of the hour, we're going to be talking about the life of Bob LaFollette, and also as it relates to Finding Bob Fest, occurring both at the Barrymore tonight and also throughout the day tomorrow up at the Sauk County Fairgrounds. In Baraboo, Nancy Unger is the author of Finding Bob LaFollette, The Righteous Reformer, and forgot to properly introduce you at the top of the hour. So just to give folks a little bit better sense of your wider background, Nancy is the Associate Professor of History at Santa Clara University out in California, and she's published many articles and essays on the LaFollette family and the Progressive Era. She served on the editorial board and is book review editor for the Journal of the Gilded Age and Progressive Era. Her op-eds, Applying the Progressive Tradition to the Present, are syndicated by the History News Service. They've appeared in major newspapers across the country. And Nancy's radio appearances include Air America, Wisconsin Public Radio, and she served as a consultant for PBS. And her current book project is Beyond Nature's Housekeepers, Turning Points for Women in American Environmental History. And I'd like to actually touch on that book in just a moment. But before we do, I guess, it was a revelation to me to learn that you are a professor in gender and women's studies, and, of course, important part of your background and your interests. I'm curious how Bob LaFollette fits into that, and maybe this is part of a wider discussion on his feelings about equality for all, civil rights. But as someone, did he have a position on the women's suffrage movement? And
well,
start
Bob,
there.
Bob La Follette, one of the problems with starting to study the La Follettes is that you start studying all of the La Follettes, including La Follette's wife, Belle La Follette,
right,
who is this fascinating woman in her own right. And sometimes I think I'd really like to spend a whole time and devote a book to her, because she's one of those wife of, and so she kind of gets, you know, left behind.
Yeah.
And she was the first woman to graduate from the University of Wisconsin Law School. And she is not just for the women's vote, but she is to use the F word, she is a feminist. And Bob La Follette was a feminist, and it did, and this started at home. I mean, he was very proud of her, and they worked together as a team. And he was horrified that women didn't have the same rights as men. It just seemed ridiculous to him.
Yeah.
It seemed undemocratic. It went against the ideals of this nation that he really did believe in so strongly. And so he was just sort of outraged by this, and he worked very hard for women to gain the vote. But it wasn't for them just the vote. They wanted full equality for women, which was pretty unusual in that time. But he was absolutely dedicated to that. He had no question about it. That was the democratic way. It's the right thing to do.
We've had the occasion to pay tribute to a number of remarkable women political leaders. And this isn't always the case, but very often you find that there is a partnership involved, and very much a partnership with the two of them.
Oh, absolutely. They really were great. I mean, not that they didn't have their moments.
Mm-hmm.
she got very upset. La Follette was so busy promoting his ideals, and they didn't have very much money, and so he would spend it to have his speeches printed and sent out to every single voter in Wisconsin. And she's saying, you know, I got the grocery bill here, and he'd say, well, what's more important? You know, what's more important? So that was difficult in raising four children. But this is just a quick quote from La Follette. He says, it is so obvious as to it hardly admit of argument. The interests of men and women are not superior nor antagonistic one to the other, but are mutual and inseparable. Woman's suffrage is but the extension of the principle of democracy and will result in a more enlightened, better balanced citizenship.
All right. Well, a great example. I want to move in just a moment to some other civil rights struggles. I think immigrant rights struggles, of course, figure into that view of viewing people equally, understanding the role of immigrants. Our guest is Nancy Unger, and she's the author of Finding Bob La Follette, The Righteous Reformer. 256-2001 is the number for your call, and we do have another caller on the line. What is your comment or question, please?
Thanks. Back in the 70s, I thought I became a feminist. In the 80s, some peace activist friends, two friends of mine from Kansas City, told me I could not be a feminist, but I could be pro-feminist. And then in the 90s, I happened to be here in Madison, and one of the questions while membershiping to be in a housing cooperative was, how do you define feminism? And I said, it's based on a person's attitude, not on their personal plumbing. And so now in the 2000s, I'm wanting to ask you, since you just talked about feminism, whether I can be a feminist, or am I wrong or right about personal plumbing not being the criteria or qualification?
You know, this subject just came up in my women's studies class that I'm taking right now. I'm trying to remember who the woman in the 90s who sort of, after Foucault and Derrida, and then there was Judith Butler, I guess I'm thinking of.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think she would say that the advice he got early on that he can't be a feminist maybe isn't correct, or does that make sense?
It's ridiculous,
yeah.
To me. I mean, to me, and obviously it depends on your definition of feminism, but to me, if you believe in the social, political, and economic equality of the sexes, you're a feminist.
Yeah.
I mean, when I first started teaching at Santa Clara, I said something in a class, and a student said to me, oh, Professor Unger, you're not a feminist, are you? And I said, well, of course I am, aren't you? And he said, oh, no. I said, oh, you don't believe in the social, political, and economic equality of the sexes? He said, well, sure I do. I said, well, you're in the club. That's, you know, that's all that it takes.
Yeah.
So according to my definition, and, you know, absolutely. I don't think that you have to be, I mean, to me that would be like saying, you know, you have to be, non-white to, advocate civil rights or something. I mean, that's just nuts. I mean, it's a big tent. Please come in and join
it. We've all got a stake in it.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for your call. And we do have another call, and this is exciting, by the way. 256-2001, if you'd like to join a conversation. Caller, what's your comment or question?
Well, originally I was going to comment about the corporate identities being able to fund politicians that you were talking about earlier. And I have an answer for that. Instead of trying to fight the definition of corporate, I think you ought to just tax every donation that a politician gets and give 50% to his opponent. That would eliminate him. Wouldn't matter then, because each guy would have an equal financial stake in any fights, in any debates, and you'd have to go back to the ideas instead of the money.
Some good thinking outside the box there. Yeah?
Yeah. One other comment, since you're talking about feminism and equality for anything, basically that's just Americanism. That's just the whole American ideal is equality.
Yeah.
Equality of opportunity. And so, you know, if you're not, you're kind of really not a true American, I guess.
Good comments. We really appreciate it. Again, 256-2001, if you'd like to join in the conversation, and you're making my job easier, everybody. We really appreciate your thoughts and your observations. Just off of that, I think this might be a good you may have a different direction to go, but a good lead to just talk a little bit about immigrant rights as they relate to equal opportunity. And I think, you know, one of the things that fascinated me, I heard a lecture recently reminding us in a related issue, which is the English-only laws that people have tried to get passed. They tried that in Wisconsin early in the century, but it failed miserably, partly because a majority of folks didn't have English as their native language.
Yeah, no, exactly. That you're right. This is an old issue that we've been fighting for a long time. And, you know, it's in California, where we have so many different languages going and a lot of Spanish speakers, it seems to me that I either hear, oh, everybody should speak English and that's so important, and on the other side is Americans are going to hell in a handbasket because we don't teach our children foreign languages and it's so important that we be able to have this and to communicate and so forth. So it becomes almost comical to me that, you know, that there doesn't seem to be any meeting in the middle. La Follette, of course, I mean, he spoke a little Norwegian because it helped him as he was traveling around talking to people in Wisconsin. But he, again, as the caller suggests, he was saying, you know, this is we're all immigrants except for the Native Americans. And, you know, of course, this is the land of immigrants and we should celebrate that and so forth. To him, it was just another non-issue that he got pretty impatient with. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
He said, and I just wanted to throw this in because I thought this was so great. In 1886, he spoke at Howard University, a traditionally African-American institution, and he spoke directly about race. Frederick Douglass was in the audience, and La Follette said, "We are one people. Our lives run side by side. Our ashes rest in the same soil. It is snobbish stupidity. It is supreme folly to talk of non-contact or exclusion."
Well, 1886, of course, not too long after Reconstruction, unfortunately, a time when we retrogressed significantly, you know, despite what happened in the Civil War and what that was all about. How did he feel about that struggle for racial justice?
Well, he was so angry about this because a lot of these racial laws were coming out of the Congress of his United States, which does not do this. So he lectured fellow members on the floor of Congress. He spoke to the white racists, and he was pointing to them. And he says, "There is nothing threatening or portentous in the Negro problem today, excepting as you make it so. The difficulty does not lie with him, but with you instead, in the blind prejudice and stubborn antagonism ever opposed to his development politically and socially as a citizen." I mean, he just called him out on this.
Yeah. Have you had a chance to examine Russ Feingold's career? And I just wonder if there's some parallels there. Very often Russ finds himself on the outs and expressing some of the same outrage about what some of his colleagues are doing for political pragmatism that just maybe aren't right, aren't resonant with American ideals.
Oh, absolutely. That you know, some of his stance, sometimes I don't agree with some of his stances. I didn't agree with all the Follettes either, but I really admire these men who stand up, these men, and there are women as well, leaders who stand up and do this. And the other thing that Feingold does that I find fascinating, these listening sessions that he has as he travels around, you know, Wisconsin and listens. It's a whole lot easier for a whole lot of us to talk than to listen. And I think that that's really a rare skill for a politician to be honing. And I think it's something that I really admire about him. Yeah.
While we're in the area of civil rights, of course, lesbian, gay, bi, and trans rights, the marriage debate, other things happening right now. We were talking earlier, I had a chance to write a column related to the thoughts that Dr. King might have had on this. And you know, luckily, it's based on talking to folks like Joseph Lowery and other folks that knew him firsthand that really feel like that was a part of the larger legacy, and certainly the way he reacted personally to important people in his campaign, like or in his movement, like Baird Rustin. Anyway, you know, in this case, there are little inklings and other things, but certainly lessons in terms of it being consistent with his general philosophy. Any resonance with that? And about
the LaFollette's neither of them I ever found them saying anything about gays and lesbians.
Not really in
the vocabulary at that time. But I know when LaFollette talked about, you know, equality for all Americans, there was no asterisk in there that said, well, except for, you know, African Americans, except for women. I mean, he meant that for everybody. And so I really, you know, I mean, I have to take him at his word that he believed in the equality of all Americans. And I know certainly his wife also, Belle LaFollette, was very aggressive in this. And something else that I admire about her, while she was fighting for the women's vote, she wasn't only fighting for the women's vote. She was fighting for all oppressed people. And in 1913, she took on the Woodrow Wilson administration because they were beginning to racially segregate Washington, D.C., which hadn't been that segregated before. Blacks and whites were working together in the government. They were sitting on streetcars together. And she says, this business of being a woman is in many ways like being a member of a despised race. So she takes on the administration. She writes these scathing columns in the Family's magazine. But that also makes me think that she also would have taken up, you know, the rights of anybody who was going to be oppressed. And, you know, I think that, gays, lesbians, I mean, it's no less un-American to discriminate on the basis of race than it is on, you know, than sexuality.
And, well, it sounds like she was ahead of her time. And without painting too broad of a brush, but of course a criticism of some of the early waves of feminism was that they were maybe mostly oriented toward the needs of white middle class people. And it sounds like she got those connections way back when.
Well, she's pretty strong. She says, to have the United States government take a backward step, to have the color line drawn in places where they have won their merit, to be humiliated, repressed, and degraded at the capital of the nation by their own government, which has no right to discriminate among its citizens, is a body blow to hope and pride and incentive. Continued violations of fundamental principles of human rights touching a race that constitutes one-tenth of our citizenship must ultimately degrade our standards, corrupt our ideals, and destroy our sense of democracy. And what I really love is that she takes on the white middle-class women who live in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
Says, look, you're the ones who have all of these African-American women raising your kids in your kitchens, cooking, cleaning, doing all this stuff for you. You have leisure time. You have education. She says she criticizes them for what she calls the absence of purpose that characterizes the social life in Washington, D.C. She reminds her white sisters that they are, quote, not supposed to belong to the butterfly and parasitic class, but should represent the earnest, intelligent womanhood of the nation. So she's just not letting anybody off the hook.
You know, I mean, it strikes me another theme here that is just the nature of both Bob and Belle as truth speakers, kind of cutting through, you know, none of the spin stuff. I mean, they're going to say exactly what they feel.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think in some ways it was easier for them, though, because there weren't other million voices. There wasn't the internet. There wasn't television. They came in very late, even for radio. So people flocked to hear people speak. And I think that's another... In some ways, I think LaFollette's would have loved the internet because it allows the people to speak and you can share communication and ideas and so forth. But boy, there's an awful lot of voices out there.
All right. Well, this is John Quinlan in A Public Affair, and we're speaking with Nancy Unger, author of Finding Bob La Follette, The Righteous Reformer. Also, a new book just out, or book project, Beyond. Still in the way? Or
oh, no. It's coming right along.
All right. Beyond mm-hmm. Nature's Housekeepers, Turning Points for Women in American Environmental History. We will come back to that in just a moment, but I think we have a couple of callers on the line. If you'd like to join in, 256-2001. Caller, what's your comment or question?
Yes. I wonder if your guest could be a little bit critical of La Follette, not quite so much of a hagiographer. I'm concerned that the left in this country has not taken a firm stand against Americanism, and that the empire and the American exceptionalism is not criticized enough. So was the La Follette a saint and never had a bad thought? What's going on?
I think you're getting that bias because of the questioner, not necessarily because of the biographer, because I know that you do have some very, very important critiques. Is that right?
Well, I got criticized pretty harshly in the Progressive magazine for not saying that, you know, for saying that La Follette did have feet of clay. And, yeah, he certainly made, in my opinion, I mean, sometimes when I'm reading his stuff, I just cringe. One of my frustrations with La Follette is he and Teddy Roosevelt are fighting about a bill at one point, and Roosevelt says, I want to get something through. Half a loaf is better than no loaf. And La Follette says, no loaf is better than half a loaf. He said it's better to go hungry and fight for the full thing than to let it go. Well, you know, realistically, you know, politics is the art of compromise. You don't always get everything that you want. And La Follette antagonized a lot of people and hurt himself, I think, in many ways. You can say, oh, isn't this wonderful that he's such a purist and he won't compromise? But I don't think that's really how, you know, how things get done. And in some ways, I think it really hindered him.
In the caller's specific question about him being a promoter of Americanism and mm-hmm. you know, how that's relevant in the here mm-hmm. and now, that nationalism maybe is something that's really hurting mm-hmm. us. Do you have some resonance there?
Well, I mean, he said, you know, yeah, America's a great country, but basically, you know, yeah, and we have all kinds of problems here, and that's what we should be focusing on. Other countries are great as well, and it's not our business to tell them how to behave. And so he really was very open in opposing American imperialism, economic imperialism, political imperialism. So, you know, they do things their way, and that's fine. And late in his life, he traveled to Europe. He said, oh, my God, everybody should go to Europe. But he says they should all go in youth because he was old and really struggling. But he runs around, and he got a lot of flack, actually, in Congress because he says, oh, look what they're doing in Denmark. Let's look at their farming methods, these co-ops that they're doing. And people are like, well, you know, we don't do that here. Well, why not? He was looking at the new Soviet Union and very excited about some of the ideas there. So I really do think that, yeah, he loved the, you know, the promise and the ideals of America, but he wasn't one of these over better than anybody else kind of things, and was very open to other countries, but I think more importantly, open to respecting other countries' differences.
I want to follow up on that just a second, just to mention one exciting part of BobFest that I'm not sure has necessarily been a major threat in the past, is that one of the breakout sessions is on international issues, in this case, issues facing people in the Middle East, in part to bring voice to Palestinian issues that sometimes don't become part of the public discourse. And Matt Rothschild of the Progressive magazine is leading that panel. You can find out more. But I wondered, you know, maybe I'm mixing up the overlap of Bob La Follette's lifetime and some of these developments, but on the League of Nations, how he stood or how he might have viewed the United Nations and its role today. Did he think outside the box in the sense of realizing that we were part of a wider global community? We needed to find better ways to work with each other?
Well, he was opposed to U.S. entry into the League of Nations.
Really?
And he said, yeah, you know, what we just got entangled into this First World War. And, you know, and look, yeah, we won, right? Now everybody hates us. It cost us all of these lives, all of this money. What did it really accomplish? If we get involved, he said, in this League of Nations, it's we're going to get dragged into other. I mean, he just felt that this was, that it wasn't going to work and that it was just going to commit us to all kinds of things. Again, his thing was, we have enough at home to worry about.
And was that because he maybe also didn't want us to become involved more fully in colonialism or intervening in others' affairs? I mean, are there positive aspects to his reasoning?
And I think, I mean, early on in his career as a congressman, he got kind of excited about some of that, the early, American involvement. And one of the things I like about La Follette is that he learns as he goes and says, now, wait, let's really look at this. And how is this affecting the people who are living in, you know, these Latin American countries and then came to be opposed to it. So I wouldn't say that he was an absolute isolationist. I don't think that is fair to say. But he was very hesitant because he felt that the United States did kind of have this, so Wilson had this kind of idea that, you know, we can have this be the war to end all wars and to make the world a safe democracy, and we're going to win the peace and all of these things. And he said, you know, that was too idealistic. It didn't work. And he felt that this idealism was going to commit Americans to future wars, future entanglements that really we had nothing to do
with. Resonant with the notion that the billions we are investing right now in foreign wars could be better spent at home.
Yeah, exactly. And he said, you know, once we get everything perfect here, then maybe we can go around and tell other people how to live. But, not until that time.
All right. We're down to about our last 5 minutes, 256-2001. One last chance if you'd like to weigh in on our conversation. But I wanted to just, come back to your latest book, Beyond Nature's Housekeepers, Turning Points for Women in American Environmental History. Explain a little bit the meaning behind the title, Beyond Nature's Housekeepers.
Well, too often when they talk about what's the difference between men and women in environmental history, how did they respond? So like, well, women were the kind of the housekeepers. They got involved in forest preservation and so forth. And I think, that's certainly true, but it's a much, much bigger story than that. So I'm really trying to look at how there's environmental history as a field, and there's women and gender history as a field, and hardly the two hardly ever meet. Mm. So I'm really trying to see, well, what difference did it make if it was a man or a woman who was involved in an environmental issue, and did environmental issues affect men and women differently? So I kind of take the ambitious view here. I start with pre-Columbian Native Americans. I talk about enslaved Americans, difference between being a female and a male slave, and how they affected the environment, and I bring it right up to the present. And if you're interested, I have done a couple of preliminary articles in the Wisconsin Magazine of History. One is on Women for a Peaceful Christmas, this idea of ending the war in Vietnam and at the same time saying we have Christmas and we buy all this junk and then we fill our landfills up with it, and let's stop buying all this stuff. If we stop buying all this stuff, we won't feed the war machine, and we can protect the environment and so forth. So, I mean, they're a great bunch. And I did another piece on this radio show in the 40s and 50s, the Say What We Think Club, a bunch of rural Wisconsin women talking about what it meant to be a woman in rural Wisconsin and their ideals and so forth. So I just, as a parting shot, I have to say the Wisconsin Historical Society, I've worked in archives all over the country. You have a gem here. It is just a fabulous place to do research.
In civil rights and social justice, we really take for granted the collection we have.
Oh, and archivists who actually want to help you use it as opposed to protect the material. So it's a wonderful place to work.
That's very refreshing. You know, as you're talking about kind of changing the meanings around the celebration of Christmas and making it less materialistic, and in the same studio about 3 months ago, we were doing honor to the memory of a local community leader, Nan Cheney, who was someone who just, as we discovered in retrospect, just was in so many different areas. But I guess she was part of a group of women here in Madison that started a project, I guess, that took off in the mid-60s.
This was Women for a Peaceful Christmas.
Yeah, I think it was, actually.
Yes.
People would gather together, make homemade gifts and other things.
Picked up in the national media. It was the Christian Science Monitor. It was in Women's Day. They received thousands and thousands of requests for how can we get this started in our community. And there's a sort of a version of this today called Buy Nothing Day. The International Buy Nothing Day is the day after our Thanksgiving, which is the biggest shopping day of the year, and it tries to promote the same idea.
Well, just about 2 minutes left, but maybe as we introduce the topic of the environment, that's something we haven't touched on. I wonder what Bob La Follette's thoughts might be today, given the global challenges we're facing, but also how he viewed this issue in terms of his native Wisconsin.
Well, I think you'll appreciate this. He said, these coal and oil vandals have been in this thing and it has made them so sordid and degraded they would blow up the Holy Sepulchre in their scramble for dirty money. He says, look what's happened here in Wisconsin. He says, the great lumber organizations, enriched by the despoilation of our natural resources in Wisconsin, have become the dictators of the public policy of the state. While we have looked on quiescently, while these great national products have been absorbed and passed under the control of the great monopolies, and then we marvel at the cost of living climbing higher and higher every year. What idiocy it is! What stupidity! What can be expected if the iron, coal, copper, and timber, which control the cost of everything else, are in the hands of the monopolies, with the result that they fix the price.
All right. Hey, Mark, if it's not too much trouble, could you cue up the track one of that music disc I gave you, just for going out? Nancy Unger, thank you. It's just been a delight, and so many wonderful things to talk about, resonances. So great that you discovered Bob La Follette and could share that enthusiasm with us all.
Well, it's always a thrill for me to be able to talk about La Follette. I really appreciate being here.
Well, we're glad to have you here again. Nancy is the author of Finding Bob La Follette, The Righteous Reformer, which first came out in 2000, I believe, and then now available in paperback. And she's also offered a new book called Beyond Nature's Housekeepers, Turning Points for Women in American Environmental History. As we've been talking about for the full hour, this is Finding Bob Fest weekend. You can find out more about all of these events at findingbobfest.org. Great website to return to throughout the year. Hope to see you all out at the events tonight and over the weekend, and in Finding Bob's spirit. Keep in there and keep on moving on, and we will see you in a couple weeks. Thanks.
Can be one. Many stones can form an arch, singly none,
and by union what we will can be accomplished still.
Drops of water turn a mill, singly none, singly none.